Welcome to Sunday School Dropouts, the podcast where an ex-Christian and a non-believing sort of Jew read all the way through the Bible for the first time.
But we finished it, so now we're talking about Bible stories that aren't actually in the Bible. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Nico.
And let's get biblical.
You got it. Reminder, this is not a Christian Bible study podcast.
And it's not appropriate for children. With that out of the way, Nico, what are we talking about today? Now that we've finished all 66 books in the Bible, we know about Jesus, we know about Jacob, we know about just to name two of the many scintillating characters we met in the canonical Bible. What are we talking about today?
Well, today is a brave and beautiful new day because it's the dawn of season three.
Season three.
And we're going to be talking about stories that seem like they should be in the Bible, but aren't.
Starting with?
Number one on the list is The Fall of Satan.
The Fall of Satan, chronologically first in the list, although we are no longer bound to any chronology.
That's true.
Nor any text.
Mm-hmm.
We're on our own, we're freeballing it.
Yeah, your human time means nothing to us now.
And we've chosen to talk about The Fall of Satan.
Now, before we get into the nit-grit, as I call it.
Mm-hmm. You gotta save time. You're a busy man.
What kind of memories do you have of learning about the fall of Satan? Or like, what did you know about the fall of Satan when you were a young religious chillum?
So actually, this is interesting because something I have in my notes here, actually, is that different Christian denominations deal with the devil differently. I was raised Presbyterian, now an atheist, forgot to mention that. Mm-hmm. And the devil was not a big deal in
not
my
a big
church.
Deal.
So I actually never literally believed in a literal devil.
Mm.
I thought only of a symbolic devil.
Right.
When I was growing up. Now, some people in my church probably did believe in a literal devil, but that wasn't like a big thing.
So along with that, you didn't know about his story, about his backstory?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But like, there's plenty of American Christians who that's a huge focus, you know?
True. And yeah. Why not? Because he's such a compelling antagonist.
Yeah.
So before we talk about his fall, I want to talk about who this man-goat is.
Yes, we've talked a little bit about Satan in the Bible before in our previous seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And how he's conceived of differently during different time periods.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes he's, you know, the accusing angel.
Sure.
Who God put in this role with the purpose of testing humans' faith. You kind of see that in the book of Job. And then later he more becomes like God's enemy who's trying to defeat God in this battle of good and evil.
Mm-hmm. And if I may, I'd like to take your points and jump off them.
Whoa.
Like such as a diving board.
Hmm, perhaps a backyard trampoline.
Perhaps. Because I want to talk a little bit about who Satan was in the old Jewish Bible. Okay.
Okay. That's fine.
In early Judaism.
By the way, Nico's the non-believing sort of Jew.
That's me. What up? So in Hebrew, Satan just mm-hmm. means an adversary or an obstacle.
Yes.
Many times in the Tanakh, the word Satan is used with no definite article, meaning just like an adversary or whatever. And in
just like an obstacle
yeah.
preventing you from getting to work on time.
Right. Several times it is used with the definite article, meaning the
Satan.
Satan. Mr. Satan. Let's say.
Mr. Satan was my father.
And a couple of those times, like one of them that you mentioned already was in Job, where Satan actually does some stuff. He has a whole conversation with God, et cetera, et cetera. Another time is in Zechariah, when Joshua is brought before an accusing angel, described as an accusing angel, and named the Satan. So, like in early Judaism, the concept of this accusing angel was like he was a part of God, or at least a part of God's organization.
Yeah,
you know,
God created this role for him,
right.
And put him in it.
That's right. The role was created for him. It's a really great opportunity with a lot of room for growth.
Now we're not just looking for anyone to fill this position.
So, even in Genesis, a place that I would think, you know, they would specifically mention Satan tempting Eve. Let's say
mm-hmm.
never mentioned.
Yeah, it just says the serpent. It
just
never
a little
says
smack.
Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And most traditions have identified that serpent with Satan, you know, including Jewish traditions from very early on.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not say that in the Bible.
I was perusing the Jewish Encyclopedia,
whoa,
as I am wont to do, and I came upon a very interesting interpretation of when this might have shifted between this idea of Satan as just a part of God's crew,
mm-hmm,
and an independent force of evil, which is much more like the oppositional character Satan that we know and, let's face it, love today.
Frankly, love.
So there's a part in Chronicles where David, King David, that is moved to request an illegal census. Do you remember this?
Yes, of course.
And it's dealt with very briefly in the book, and it's very confusing. But
yes,
he asks for a census, and it leads to a plague. That passage starts with God inciting David to call the census.
Yes.
But earlier versions of the same text indicated that it was the adversary that did it.
Yeah, we see that there's the difference between in Kings and in Chronicles.
Right.
One says that God told him to do this census and that it was sinful. Thanks God for nothing. And the other says that Satan made him do it. So clearly between the two, there was some shift.
And some people think that shift is, in fact, the exile.
Mm.
Because Jewish writers are out there picking up brand new ideas, integrating lots of new traditions, especially Zoroastrian ones, which,
yes,
was the dominant religion in the empire in which they were exiled.
Yes. So for anybody who doesn't remember from our first two seasons, or specifically from our first season where we talked about the Babylonian exile, every single episode it felt like, that was when Babylon took over Israel, destroyed Jerusalem, and exiled everybody for 66 years until Persia took over and let them go back to Jerusalem.
Right. And so in that process,
Zoroastrianism is from ancient Persia.
So in that process, they're picking up a bunch of new mythologies, checking out fresh gods, fresh, you know, takes on the whole system.
The whole divinity game.
Right. And one of those integrations might have been this idea of a counterpoint to God that is pure evil.
Hmm.
During that same period, during that exile period, is when a lot of other Jewish pseudepigrapha is dated to as well.
Pseudepigrapha, you say?
The important ones. For example, Book of Enoch, Book of Jubilees.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one whose name I don't remember. It's called like Wisdom of Moses or something.
Something like that. We didn't read that one.
No, but you can go back and listen to our Enoch episode if you want some hot secret knowledge.
Yes, and that's where we've talking.
Mm-hmm. That's where we've talking.
That's where we've talked about fallen angels before.
That's right.
So in Enoch, some angels, better known to us as the evil fuck angels,
mm-hmm,
decide to go down to Earth to bring humans forbidden knowledge and to have sex with human women. There's no inciting incident. They just decide.
Just for
that
a
looks
larf,
fun,
you know.
Yeah. And, of course, their children are a race of monstrous cannibalistic giants, and those are called the Nephilim. The Nephilim are mentioned very briefly in the book of Genesis,
mm-hmm,
and God tries to wipe them out with the flood, but there's still a few left after the flood, but the Israelites get the rest of them.
Anyway, one of the things that these pseudepigraphal books do is establish the idea that there are fallen angels, like you said. And they describe it in great detail when the idea of fallen angels is only briefly mentioned in what's left of the canonical Bible now. In Enoch, the lead angel is identified as both Azazel and Satanael.
Yes.
Two names for an angel that basically started a rebellion against God and brought an army of angels and lost.
And as I mentioned in the Enoch episode, Azazel still means, like, in modern Hebrew, to say damn it, you say Le'Azazel.
Mm-hmm. So here you can see the different threads of early Judaism combining,
mm-hmm,
where you're trying to integrate some of these ideas about this, like, oppositional evil dude with the existing text. So they're sort of filling in details, you know, like brief mentions in Genesis about the sons of God coming down to earth and creating the Nephilim can, like, get greatly,
you can build that out,
expanded
outside of the Bible. Similarly, the fall of Satan is briefly mentioned in the canonical Bible a couple times. In Luke 10:18, Jesus says that he saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. And Revelation, of course, has a couple of verses about Satan as the great dragon who was hurled to the earth and his angels with him.
And that story in Revelation is very similar to a sort of Jewish folktale that was written down in a couple places most notably in some of the texts from that sweet Dead Sea.
Oh.
One of those secret scrolls.
So I don't know anything about the Jewish mythological version of this. All I know is the brief mentions in the Bible, and you are now going to educate me on that.
I will do my gosh darn best, my dear.
Well, that's all I can ask from you.
So there are basically two versions of the story in Jewish folklore, basically. Okay. Two dominant versions. In the first one, Satan is God's greatest angel. He's beautiful and blameless until somewhere around the second day of creation. He sins for some reason.
Okay. I mean, one day of creation could be like a million years. We don't know.
That's fair.
God's on a different timeline.
And because of his sin, he decides to set his throne higher than God's. You know, he's like, I'm impressed with what God's done so far, but I think I can do better.
Hmm.
Which, I admire that kind of gumption and
that
go-getting
kind of moxie
attitude. However, God did not admire it. So Satan brought an army of angels to battle with God's, lost, and God sent him to live forever in Sheol. Which is like sort of the abyss.
Yes, it's like an early Hebrew version of hell, but it's not really hell the way that
it's
we
closer
think
to
of
purgatory.
It now. It's just kind of a nothingness.
Because later they clarify in some of the other pseudepigraphal books that Sheol is where everybody who's dead has to wait for Judgment Day.
Yes.
So it's right. Sort of like purgatory. The point is, it's dull as heck down there.
Yeah, it's not great.
And a place where no right-minded angel would want to be. The second version of this story, Satan is also still one of God's top angels. People can't seem to get over that, considering in the Bible he like has conversations with God.
Yeah.
He's also blameless until the sixth day now.
Okay.
When Adam is created.
Okay.
God tells the angels to bow before his newest and greatest creation, Adam. You know, he says, this is my son. I made him in my image. He's like the best thing I've ever made. So angels,
Take the knee.
He's top of the chain now. And as you can imagine, Satan is not happy about that at all.
Because he used to be the second biggest.
At least the most beautiful, blameless angel.
Okay.
Everybody's
beautiful,
big,
blameless angels.
Everybody's
the best angels.
On blamelessness. Okay. I don't know why that's such a good trait. I'm going to ride it out, though.
Okay.
Again, Satan raises a host of angels, goes to battle with God, big battle in the sky, and he loses. He's cast out again to Sheol. However, he does get his revenge by impersonating a snake in the Garden of Eden and tempting Eve, closing that loop. So those are the two sort of stories about the fall of Satan. Interestingly, by the time we get to like 100 CE or 200 CE, like mainstream rabbinical Judaism,
mm-hmm.
not the like folk tale part of it,
mm-hmm.
had completely gotten shot of the idea of Satan as an oppositional force. Like they were like, no, Satan never rebelled. The idea that an angel could rebel against God is a distraction and a waste of thought.
That makes sense because once Christianity starts, there are some things that like, so if you think of Christianity as like an offshoot of Judaism,
mm-hmm.
it takes all this Jewish mythology and, you know, kind of runs with it in a different direction.
Right.
And there's several things that once Christians run with them, that Jews are like, yeah, you can have that.
Right.
We're not that interested
this
in that
This
is anymore.
Very much one of those, because
yeah.
like the period immediately before Christ came about was a time of great turmoil in the Jewish faith,
yeah.
obviously. And they were trying to work out what to keep and what to reject in terms of all of the influences that they have been exposed to. And one of the things that rabbinical Judaism decided to refuse was the idea of a pure evil angel. You know, they're just like, don't talk to me about that. But like you said, Christianity decides to run with it.
Yeah. Same with like the idea of the Messiah. You know, like obviously that's huge in the Old Testament. We talked about it over and over, Messiah and Judgment Day and all
mm-hmm.
that. And then like,
that gets really downplayed.
Yeah. Nowadays, like Jews don't care about that at all. You know, it's very small. And then it's like the entire like theology of some Christians.
In traditional rabbinical Judaism, even Satan in Job, for example, is like consensus thought is it's a metaphor
mm.
for the urge to commit evil that is in every person, not a description of a real angelology, you know, of a real, like, conversation or a real glimpse into the working order of the universe.
But you keep specifying rabbinical Judaism. Does that mean that folk Judaism still hung on to the idea of Satan?
I think folk Judaism hung on to a lot of stuff for a long time.
Okay. And that probably varies by region.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
To get back briefly to the fall of Satan in the Bible, one of the places it is mentioned, sort of, but that has become a real important piece of literature for the idea of the fall of Satan is Isaiah 14.
Yes. And this is the morning star passage.
That's right. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. I'm reading the NRSV, of course, because I'm a big brain, smart
boy.
I'm
a big nursive.
How you are cut down to the ground, you who lay the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of assembly on the heights of Zaphon. So, a lot of people, famously, in the Vulgate translation of the Bible, the first translation into Latin, Shining One or Daystar was translated as Lucifer.
Right, just because it means shiny or whatever.
Right.
Like loose as in light.
Right. Which helped inform the connection a lot of people made between this speech and the idea of a fallen angel.
Yes.
Even though this speech is almost certainly a political one.
Right. And it's, yeah, that's not how it was intended by the author of Isaiah.
Interestingly, it's suggested that this is actually an allusion to a story about a fallen angel.
Oh, interesting.
Something that a lot of people would be familiar with.
But not Satan?
But not Satan.
Are we talking about the fuck angels again?
That it was a common...
It was just like a trope, like a metaphorical trope, like anybody can fall.
Yeah, I think it is. Because there's a famous fallen angel in Canaanite mythology.
Okay.
And there's another one in Babylonian mythology as well. So it was a common thing that cropped up a lot.
Can you tell me anything about those?
So the Canaanite one is a fellow named Athtar, apparently.
Athtar.
A powerful semi-deity who rebelled against Baal but failed and was sent to rule the underworld instead.
That sounds very much like our Fall of Satan myth.
And there's another Babylonian dude that did the same thing. I didn't write down his name, but...
We'll just call him Derek.
Yep. Derek did the same thing. He got all up in... Whose ass? Ur's ass? Who's the Babylonian guy?
There's a lot of Babylonian guys.
Anyway, he got up in somebody's ass and got sent to hell for it. Anyway, so...
Harsh but fair.
I think the idea is, even if he wasn't specifically talking about the Satan in the Bible, it was an allusion to a trope of a story, just like you said, that people would be familiar with and would be able to interpret in light of the political references.
Okay, so it's not too far off from the Fall of Satan story.
I don't think. I don't think it is.
Adjacent.
But then people get real into Isaiah and the other prophets speaking actual religious prophecy.
Isaiah is the biggest one.
For Christians, right?
For Christians to say that, like, oh, Jesus was predicted by Isaiah, which obviously isn't the case, but whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Reading things into Isaiah is a time-honored tradition at this point.
With that in mind, how does this biblical implication of Satan or the fall of Satan start to play into, like, Christian ideas?
Right. So for this episode, you researched Jewish stuff. I researched Christian stuff. So as I was saying before, you know, Christianity will sometimes take a idea from Judaism, and then that becomes more of a Christian thing because Jews are like, we don't need that anymore. You know, go to town, buddy. So this is also true with Satan. And if there are two versions of the myth that you mentioned, one where Satan just tries to overpower God, and one where he refuses to bow down to Adam, Christianity will be disruptive in the space.
Okay.
And introduce...
I love disruption, personally.
I love it when it's seamless. But Christianity will introduce a third version of this story where Satan refuses to bow down to Jesus. So it's similar to not bowing down to Adam.
Yeah.
But we're going to make
they're both
Christian now.
Sons of God, right?
Yes. And so different denominations deal with this differently. As I was saying, like, I had no knowledge of, like, any Fall of Satan type narrative when I was growing up. But there are different, like, Catholics have kind of like an official version of the fall of Satan, and
sure.
the Orthodox Church has kind of an official version.
Right.
But of course, the most famous and influential one is going to be Paradise Lost by John Milton.
Okay.
So let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about Milton.
You got it. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. See ya, babies.
Welcome back to Sunday School Dropouts. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Nico.
And we are talking about The Fall of Satan. In fact, we are talking about Paradise Lost by John Milton.
Now you tell me about this book.
Okay. Long-time listeners might have noticed that at the beginning of this episode, we did not do fast facts.
Funny about that. You know
and
what?
Long-time listeners might remember that I am on a personal quest to transform this podcast into just a dull recitation of trivia facts.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to do some of that. Are you ready?
Yes, please.
Paradise Lost, published in 1667 in Ingerland.
Okay.
So think kind of the next generation after Shakespeare died.
Okay.
Like much of Shakespeare's work, it is written in blank verse, which is to say non-rhyming iambic pentameter.
Nice.
And after the first printing, they had to, when they did the second printing, they had to add a note at the beginning of the book that said, this poem doesn't rhyme because rhyming is for babies, so get over it. Apparently.
Were people returning it? And being
apparently
like,
they'd gotten some listener mail.
I bought this book and it does not rhyme.
Milton was a Protestant and he was fine with any Protestant denomination, not a big fan of the Catholics.
Okay.
Or the Jews. Or the Muslims.
Yeesh.
Yeah. He was a supporter and employee of Oliver Cromwell.
Okay.
Not because he was a Puritan, but because he was a small R Republican. He was for representative government. He didn't want a king. He didn't want a monarchy.
Yeah.
And you can see how that might cause him to be interested in a story about defying a monarch,
right.
defying a king.
Mm-hmm. Especially the usurpation.
I don't know.
Especially the usurpment of the divine right.
Yes.
Right, which was the big thing. That was the big idea that kings were pushing back then.
Yes.
They're like, hey, God told me to be king. What are you going to argue with that?
You can't argue. Except Oliver Cromwell did argue and, mm-hmm. in fact,
successfully.
And, in fact, killed the king. But with Paradise Lost, Milton was trying to write an epic poem like the Iliad or the Odyssey. Your Iliads, your Odysseys.
Your Gilgamesh.
So he relies heavily on classical themes and tropes. So like throughout this entire book, it's very, very heavily like Greco-Roman references constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be like
Greco-Roman referencing?
Yes. Queensbury rules.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be like, oh, it's just like Achilles, you know, wore his shield, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
So that's really interesting to me because I feel like from very early on, Christianity...
You wanted to be a gangster.
...is kind of like, what if Greco-Romans tried to do Judaism? you know, like ever since Paul made his mission spreading Jesus to the Gentiles, then within a couple hundred years, you've got Roman emperors as Christians. And then you've got all the Greco-Roman influences like slammed into the Jewish influences.
Right.
And we don't think about it that way anymore, at least not in America.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like actually kind of the defining.
I mean, that's very true and a very smart point. Like Paul is very much trying to reconcile a lot of that stuff, like the philosophy, the idea of like Greek philosophy combined with Jewish tradition.
And that's probably the stuff that like led to our current conception about Jesus' divinity. Like it has influences from like, oh, well, you know, in Rome, there was a lot of, like you would say, the emperor was the son of God.
Right.
So that influenced how we think of Jesus and, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of the entire point of this book, is mixing those two things.
Hmm. So in its own way, it's like a return to early Christianity in that way.
Yeah.
Knowingly or unknowingly.
Yeah. And like really, I guess, says something about Christianity, probably unwittingly, but it's interesting. Especially because, you know, the Greco-Roman gods are very humanish.
Sure.
They, you know, they get jealous and they...
They're defined by their flaws rather than by their strengths.
Right. They make mistakes. They do all kinds of stuff. They interact with humans a lot. It's just that they're magical. They're more powerful.
Right.
And so, like, what if you applied that kind of ethos to biblical figures? What if you applied that to Satan?
Sounds fun. Sounds like a winner to me.
Made a, you know, a humanized Satan who was against monarchy. And
yeah, what if he went to high school with Abraham Lincoln and the Buddha?
And it was like way, way back in the 1980s?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Milton uses this new Christian version of the myth where Satan refuses to bow down to Jesus.
Mm. So in that version of the myth, just to be clear, Satan is all on board, still a pillar of the organization until God announces the plan to send his son down to earth to save everybody?
Well, here's the thing.
Okay.
Because,
I mean, like, look, if the boss was promoting his son over his top employee, you know,
mm-hmm.
I got to sympathize with the employee.
The thing is that Christians had to retcon the creation story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in most Christian denominations. They have to say that Jesus, because he is the same as God, part of the Trinity, was
He existed since day one.
During creation, yeah.
Or day zero, I guess.
Since day zero, yeah. So in Paradise Lost, what happens is that, like, after all the angels are created, God creates all the angels.
Right.
And then he creates Jesus, who is, like, his son, but also himself.
Part of him, right.
Yes. Yeah. And he tells all the angels to bow down to this new co-king that he has. And Satan is like, well, that's not what I signed up for. Like, we established this whole hierarchy of angels and I was at the top. And, you know, maybe we didn't all have the same rank, but we were more or less equal. We were all, you know, the same kind of thing. And now you're just bringing
making
in
up
this
new
guy.
Yeah.
And I didn't sign up for that. He should just be an angel, same as the rest of us, you know. So he decides to rebel. And he gets a lot of angels on his side. He gets millions of angels, in fact, about half of them in heaven.
Okay.
So that's a lot.
Right.
Yeah. It's pretty convincing. He gets like half the dudes on his side.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have the big battle. That's actually in the middle of the book, but I'm just going to cut to the feeling here because this is an English major dropout.
But you enjoyed the battle, right? I heard you.
Yeah.
I heard you. Gasping and
yeah,
and whooping along with each
wasn't
blow
whooping.
Of the mace.
Don't you dare accuse me of whooping. No, but it is. It's really great. And it's like super dramatic battle scene. And they've got, you know, swords and shields and spears and stuff. For some reason, this is all already invented. And the first day of the battle, things are really even. Neither side is winning because there's like equal millions of angels on each side. And at one point, the Archangel Michael is fighting Satan hand to hand, and he slices through him with his sword.
Wow.
Michael slices through Satan with a sword. And it goes all the way through him, and Satan is surprised to find that it hurts really bad.
Hmm.
He has never felt pain before. But he like bleeds nectar and then the wound immediately heals back up because he's like an angel. But he's kind of like, oh, like I thought I was hot shit. I thought I was at the top of the hierarchy and no one could possibly defeat me. And I just found out that I can get angel sliced pretty bad.
Right.
Like our sides are
evenly matched.
It's a powerful
metaphor for the moment that each of us is angel sliced.
Right. When you're angel sliced. That feel when you're angel sliced. And like I thought I was going to win this no problem, but our sides are really evenly matched. His thought process is very analogous to like an entitled rich white person where he's like he's never felt pain before, but he thinks that he is owed everything.
Sure.
He's angry that there's one step above him on the hierarchy when he's actually at the top of the hierarchy. So that night he puts a positive spin on it for his troops. And instead of saying like, well, we're not quite doing as well as I thought we would, he's like, we're doing great. We're doing better than I thought I would because like God is supposed to be omnipotent, but we're evenly matched. So he's clearly not omnipotent.
Yeah, you would think so.
And I'm going to do something that's going to win, and that's invent cannons. So then...
Wait, really?
He invents cannons, and then they shoot... The next day, they shoot cannons at the good angels, and the good angels are like, what the fuck is this? And they're all laughing at them as they get hit by cannonballs.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's dope as hell.
Then the good angels decide to pick up mountains and throw them at the bad angels. And
nature's cannon.
There is actually like a parenthetical that's like, oh yeah, heaven also has mountains. It's just like, there's like literally it's in parentheses.
He hadn't even made the mountains yet.
Well, he made them in heaven.
I guess you'd got to test them out first before you put them in production.
Right. Anyway. Yeah, prototype. So then we cut to God's throne room and he's in there with Jesus, who is actually never referred to as Jesus. He's only referred to as the Son or Messiah.
Cool.
Because I guess he hasn't taken the human form of Jesus yet.
Right.
And he is telling Jesus, like, obviously I knew this war was going to happen. I'm God. I know everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I let them duke it out for a while because I'm all about free will. I don't want people to worship me just because I make them do it. They have to choose it freely. Otherwise, it's meaningless.
Hmm. Does that square with your interpretation of the Bible?
It does not square with Presbyterianism, but it does square with other denominations. And it was like a really big deal in the past. I don't know. You know, like, remember in high school English class that we were always reading, like, Moby Dick was all about, is it fate or is it free will?
Mm-hmm.
And now we don't really care about that, but it was like kind of a big deal back then. I don't know. It's a really big deal in this book. It's like the entire founding ethos of God's like universe is like, angels need to be able to choose whether they worship me. Humans need to be able to choose. They have to be able to choose or it's meaningless.
Got it.
So he's like, I let them all choose which side they're on. But obviously I can defeat these dudes really easily. And in fact, I'm going to let you do it, son. So everyone knows.
Jesus goes to war?
So everyone knows that you're my co-king and you're equal to me. And so Jesus is like, oh, thanks, Dad. And he gets to take the chariot from Ezekiel. Like the sapphire throne that's pulled by like wheels within wheels and the like four faced angels and stuff. He gets to take that out onto the battlefield and he just like one hit kills Satan and all his armies into a portal and sends them to hell. And it's great.
Dad, can I borrow the keys tonight?
Right? So the very person who Satan was like, this guy isn't more powerful than me. I won't bend down to him. Like, that's, of course, the guy who defeats him. And what's really great about this, this shit is so good. I never had to read this in school. This is the first time I read it. It's so good because Milton makes you realize along with Satan just how outmatched he is. So every time it's like, oh, I didn't know angels could get sliced. You realize that at the same time as Satan does. Mm-hmm. So you go into it thinking like, oh, he's evenly matched. Like, he's doing pretty good. And then it's like, oh, just kidding. Oh, no. Oh, Jesus is going to one hit kill him. Mm-hmm. And so like you experience it along with Satan. You kind of sympathize with him. Okay, so now they're, the rebellious angels all get sent to hell. And now they're demons.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in fact, live in the capital city of hell, which is called Pandemonium.
Yeah.
or
all demons, baby.
Yeah. Satan kind of gives a Braveheart speech where he's like, you know, it sucks that, you know, heaven was super tight and now we have to live in hell where it's all like creepy flames that don't cast light. But better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. That is a direct quote.
That's the most famous quote from the book,
right?
That is
a direct quote from it.
That's the one that all the action movies use when they're trying to sound badass.
Right.
And you really don't think that they've considered what they're talking about.
I thought it was a Hot Topic t-shirt, mm-hmm. but it is actually a quote from Paradise Lost.
Because, I mean, Satan's deluding himself.
Yes. And what's great is that, again, you don't have really any more information than Satan whenever, like, at this point in the narrative. So you're kind of deluded along with him.
Mm-hmm.
We do this big roll call of all the fallen angels who are now demons, and they are all like Moloch and Dagon and all like the pagan gods from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also like Osiris and Isis, like, because those are pagan gods, you know, that the Egyptians worshipped. Therefore, they had to be demons in Milton's mind.
Very harsh.
And then also Titan and Jove and all the Greek and Roman gods, they're all pagan gods, obviously, so they have to be demons. But it's weird because every other sentence is like, you know, just as Jove defeated Saturn, so, you know, God smote Satan, but then like Jove is a demon. Like Jove is literally named as a demon. So you're like, okay, there's some wires crossed here. All that is before the first day of creation.
Okay.
So after that, now that Satan and his armies are down in hell, now God creates, let there be light, creates water, whatever, and creates earth and humans. And I don't know if this is Milton's invention or if he's just using this framework that already existed, but in Paradise Lost, God creates the earth and creates humans kind of to make up for the lost angels, because he lost half his angels. So he lost half his like worshiping power. And so he's creating a new world with new beings that will worship him
to get back his power.
Kind of. It never says that. Like, he's always omnipotent. He doesn't need to get back power, but like,
maybe the house just feels a little empty,
yeah.
You know, and he needs to just fill up his days with something.
But of course Satan has to go creep up there and, you know, tempt Eve and stuff.
Yeah, creep and sneak.
Yeah, he has to creep and sneak. And so as he goes up there, God and Jesus are watching from above, and God explains that, of course, he loves free will more than anything. So the humans need...
Especially if you're English.
The humans need to be able to decide whether they're going to be tempted or whether they're going to obey God and not eat the fruit from the tree.
Mm-hmm.
But he also says that, like, Satan chose to rebel from, like, first principles, and humans are only going to rebel because Satan tempts them to.
I see. So it's not a valid rebellion.
So they get, like, a little more leeway.
They can be saved.
They can be saved. They're not automatically going to be sent down to hell. Well, at first he's like, I mean, but they are, like, I'm going to have to send them to hell if they sin, unless someone here wants to sacrifice themselves. And it says, like, all the angels in heaven, like, stayed quiet. Like, everyone just shuts up because everyone's like, not it. And then Jesus is like, I'll do it. And they're like, oh, Jesus, you're so amazing. Like, you truly are the equal of God, blah, blah, blah. So Satan tempts Eve, of course. We know she eats the apple. She gets Adam to eat the apple. But there is one thing that I wanted to mention about Adam and Eve. Like, half the book is with Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And the archangel Raphael comes down to, like, talk with them and explain some shit. And just because we've mentioned the fuck angels, I want to mention that, A, obviously, of course, Adam and Eve are naked.
Mm-hmm.
And it specifically says that Raphael, like, sees Eve naked but isn't tempted because he's not a fuck angel.
Cool. Oh, okay.
Then,
he's one of the good ones.
Yeah. And then also Adam asks Raphael if angels have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And Raphael's like, well, I'm not going to say one way or the other, but...
Just say no, dude.
I will say that everything that brings you pleasure on Earth is even better in heaven.
Wow.
And, you know, imagine if you weren't constrained by physical bodies and you could just join souls in perfect desire.
Talk about freaky.
So, yes, the answer is yes, angels fuck. In fact, they super fuck. Anyway, humans get kicked out of Eden. Satan feels very triumphant. From his point of view, he's gotten revenge on God by messing up the substitute angels. Okay, so he doesn't get to reign in heaven, but he is reigning in hell, and he can go around on earth and do whatever he wants and tempt people. But of course, little does he know that God already foresaw all of this, and one day Jesus will die for everyone's sins, and then there'll be the final Armageddon battle, and sin and death and Satan will be defeated once and for all, and so that actually everything worked out for God's plan in the end.
But based on that story, I mean, once God wraps this thing up, he's just going to do something to create more complications in the future. Seems like he's somebody that can never take just letting it, you know, be static.
Well, you might say the same thing about Satan.
I might.
Think about that.
But I won't.
And also, it's kind of interesting because what's so innovative about Paradise Lost is that you sympathize with Satan.
Right.
And his motivation is all really clear. And you see him when he's angry and when he's happy. And he's just like a totally fully drawn character.
Mm-hmm.
Much more fully drawn than Eve, by the way. This book is sexist as hell. Like, Eve is a dumb bitch. And it's like she has to do all the cooking, even though cooking doesn't exist yet. Like, she has to just like put fruit on the table, like unpeel fruit. But yeah, Satan's like super humanized and sympathetic. And you know that Milton sympathizes with the idea of not wanting a monarch.
Sure.
You know, so you get the idea that that's where all this sympathy is coming from. But he has to insert all this stuff about like, well, when the monarch is literally God and is literally perfect, like that's fine. That's right. A good monarchy. But every other human monarchy, that's bad.
Yeah, it's a very interesting stretch to create a scenario in which God ordains rebellions.
Yeah.
Like God says there always need to be rebellions and people thinking for themselves and having free will. You know, and in any other case besides if the king is actually God, you know, it's actually good.
Yeah. But when the king is literally God, that's good. You got to obey that king. So that's Paradise Lost.
That's amazing. So what do we think about this story of the fall of Satan?
How are we going to rate this book when there's no book?
Well, yeah, there's no book, first of all. But like,
rate this myth.
Does it fulfill some sort of role in Christianity and Judaism? Like, obviously it's a popular story and one that has been around in some form or another for a long, 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 long time.
I guess to me, I think what's appealing about it is that it is more in the style of Greco-Roman gods, where it brings divine motivations down to a level that humans can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And we can all think about somebody rebelling, somebody not wanting to be controlled, somebody wanting to be more powerful than they are, that all we can relate to. And that makes it seem, it's just easier to wrap your head around than an omnipotent, omniscient God
sure.
who, you know, can't microwave a burrito so hot that only he could eat. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
You know, the famous burrito microwave.
Absolutely. Paradox.
Paradox, thank you.
For me,
mm-hmm.
we've talked many times before about how sort of folklore and mythology like fills in the gaps of this stuff, specifically when we were talking about early Christian writings and everybody was obsessed with Jesus and Jesus' story and his family's story.
Yeah, and
they had to make up a bunch of stuff.
Stories about Jesus' childhood. And
so in that same way, I think this story is filling in a gap. And the gap I think it's filling in is the issue of, I mean, it's like the thorniest religious issue, which is that
why does evil exist?
Why does evil exist? Why do bad things happen at all if there's an omnipotent God? And I think it's much more palatable to believe in a force that's diametrically opposed to God. God always wants good for everybody, and the devil is always trying to tempt everybody and create evil in the world. And it's that balance that is much more reflective of people's real life than, you know, a good God that lets bad things happen, which
that's
is
true.
Very difficult to understand.
That's true.
On like an intuitive level. So I think people really like this story and these stories about Satan because they explain why bad things happen.
And they do it on a scale that's understandable.
Yeah.
All right, great. We solved all theology and
check it
nobody
off
needs to go to church
the
anymore.
List. So, but how do we rate it?
Well, I'll tell you, Paradise Lost gets a 9 out of 10 from me.
Dope.
Minus one because it's so fucking sexist.
Right.
But, like, Adam was like, Raphael, I know that my wife is a dumb bitch, but sometimes I listen to her because she's so hot. And Raphael's like, don't do that. Don't ever listen to her.
Oh, that's unpleasant. But 17th century is long over, thankfully. And
yeah,
no one
thankfully there's no sexism
any
anymore.
Any opinions like that yeah. anymore. For me, the whole Fall of Satan experience, I got to give that like 6 out of 8 sliced angels.
Sliced angels. This is of course, Eve had to unpeel and slice the angels.
That's right.
Even though there was no cooking yet.
It's pretty fun. It feeds into a lot of other fun parts of Jewish mythology, like the angelology, demonology, et cetera, et cetera. And it was an interesting peek at sort of how other influences got into early Judaism and the Bible and Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty fun for me. 6 out of 8.
Excellent.
Now, Lauren, we've been away for a minute.
Yes, we have.
And that has expressed itself most clearly.
We didn't check our email. We didn't check the Sunday School Dropouts email for the last like 9 months. Because you have to understand that we moved from San Francisco to New York. We got hired. We got laid off. We got hired. We're taking math classes. Everything is very busy in our lives. And we're really sorry that we didn't answer any emails. There are too many to answer on air, so we will be responding to them individually. If you sent one and we haven't responded by the time that you are hearing this episode, please feel free to email again and just up it on the queue and we will respond. However, there is one email we need to address. It is from friend of the show, Brendan, aka We Are Foxhound on Twitch. I think, I don't really know what Twitch is. I mean, I know what it is, but I never used it. But anyway, he sent us an email where he analyzed all of our ratings for all the different Bible books in seasons 1 and 2.
Finally applying data science to the thing it needs to be applied to, which is the nonsense that comes out of our mouths.
Yes. So for example, Jubilees, he writes, is indisputably ranked as the best book owing to Lauren's perfect score of 70 out of 70 raven yellings at. Even just 5 fewer ravens would drop it down to number 4, he says.
Apparently, Exodus narrowly edges out the tied Esther and Ecclesiastes for the number 2 slot, a surprisingly close fight for a book so filled with classic Bible content.
Gospel of Luke is the highest ranked gospel. Titus is the worst book. Remember our Titus episode? We barely even talked about Titus. And then he also looked at the biggest differences, like the ones where we rated books the most differently. Where I gave 1 John a tepid 4 out of 9 concluding affirmations, while Nico gave it 69 out of 420 testimonies, Nico's score being very low, albeit, let's be honest, hilarious.
Lauren also gave the second epistle of John a score of 0, and I gave it a 50% score, so this is a strong differentiator. But Brendan doesn't think it's reflective of a huge split in opinion on that shitty letter.
I don't even remember like which one Second John is, but apparently I hated it.
Fair enough.
And of course, we do need to bless and curse cats and dogs on this show. We will bless and curse your pets if you send us an email with a photo of the animal and its name. We will give it a biblical curse or blessing.
Those are two very important parts of the process.
And they're basically the foundation of the show.
So we're going to be blessing dogs and cursing cats en masse here because we got so many beautiful animals coming to us electronically. To all the cats, Timothy for Graham, Freya, who is actually a turtle, for Brendan, unnamed neighbor cat for Steve, Mr. Ash for Thomas, unnamed neighbor cat number 2 for Liz, Teddy Vader and Skywalker for Justine, and Pancake, who is actually a bunny. We had problems cursing a bunny, but we're going to do it because it's for Lucy. This is what I say to you. You too have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your harps, maggots are the bed beneath you, and worms are your covering.
Wow. As for dogs, we have Brendan's dog, Polo, Peggy's dog, Blossom, and Julie wanted a blessing for all the lost dogs who will never be reunited with their owners because their owners think that microchips are the mark of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
To them, I say, oh, dogs, Best are all things, as the will of God ordained them, his creating hand nothing imperfect or deficient left of all that he created.
Beautiful. If you want to reach out to the show, send us a dog or cat, ask us a question, or maybe just say hello.
We'll actually be checking the email now, so please email us at contact@sundayschooldropouts.lol.
You can also follow us on Twitter at SunSchoolDrop.
You can follow me on Twitter at Lauren E. O'Neill. O'Neill spelled with an A like Shaquille spells it.
You can follow me on Twitter for things that are definitely not bits. All 100% true things on my TL. I am at Niko Bakulich, N-I-K-O-B-A-K-U-L-I-C-A.
You can find him yelling about his peanut supper 100% sincerely on Twitter. Of course, thank you to Niko as always for our engineering and mixing and whatever, editing. And thank you to Elise Carlton for our beautiful logo.
We will be back in 2 weeks. That's right. We're changing the format of the show. Just a little slipperoo on you there.
Sorry. Sorry, moms.
We'll see you in 2 weeks. There's so much more amazing stuff to talk about. I'm psyched to be back for season 3. I could tell by the steely look in Lauren's eye that she is both psyched and determined to provide you with top-notch entertaining content.
True.
You're just going to have to wait, though, for now. My name is Niko.
I'm Lauren.
And we'll see you on the Hell.
On Sunday. Bye.
Bye.